I'm Michael Cross, host of the KOSU Daily Podcast. Every weekday, I bring you the biggest Oklahoma stories of the day with reporting and analysis from our team of journalists and partners. Get the news you need to start your day in less than 10 minutes. Find the KOSU Daily in your podcast feed and subscribe now.
This Week in Oklahoma Politics is sponsored by the Oklahoma State Medical Association, cornerstone of Oklahoma medicine with physician members who are committed to better health for all Oklahomans. Learn more at okmed.org.
For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and civil rights attorney Ryan Kiesel. Earlier this week, Oklahomans joined voters in 14 other states in deciding their picks in the presidential primary. Former President Donald Trump got nearly 82% of the Republican vote compared to under 16% for Nikki Haley. In the Democratic primary, which included independent voters, President Joe Biden got 73%. Neva, were there any surprises for you?
Well, no surprises in the winners. I mean, obviously, we expected that. And the Associated Press that night took 16 minutes for them to call after the polls closed the elections. But I think the surprise for me was that there had been a lot of discussion about whether or not turnout would be lower on the Republican side with the just assumed outcome the way it would be, but in fact there were about 25% of registered Republicans that voted, so that turned out to be very close to what it was 4 years ago. And with respect to the numbers for Donald Trump, he had the second most ever in a Republican presidential primary here in Oklahoma, and that actually was only behind the first time in 2020 when he chalked up about 19,000 more votes, somewhere in that vicinity. So bottom line, Trump wins with 82% in Oklahoma, Biden wins with 73%. Nikki Haley on the Republican side did get 16%. But what was interesting in the presidential preference primary overall was the fact that there was no activity by either side, no money spent, no fly-ins, nothing. It was strictly Oklahomans stating their preference on who they wanted to be their nominee in their respective parties. And it's noteworthy also that the Libertarians, for the first time, also had the opportunity to cast their ballots in their own presidential preference primary, and their candidate won with 61% of the vote over the second individual. So chalk it up in the books. I think we see that it sets up for the rematch in November, and it will be interesting. I think it's hard to believe that the results are going to be much different looking down the road with respect to the outcome in November and how Oklahomans will vote based on the pattern we've seen, based on the fact that every time Donald Trump has been on the ballot, he's won all 77 counties. And every time Republicans in presidential election years and voters in Oklahoma of all persuasion have gone with the Republican candidate for president of the United States.
Orion.
Well, and I think that at the risk of revealing that I don't know everything, I wasn't really sure that there were going to be candidates on the ballot against Joe Biden. So I showed up at my local polling place just in case, and lo and behold, there were some candidates on there, and I was able to cast my preferential primary ballot for Joe Biden. And walked out. I think it was the fastest voting that I've ever done in my entire.
Well, only 8% of Democrats and Independents voted on that side in the state.
Yeah, so. And I think that part of that there are I think some different takeaways there. One is one of the things that you mentioned, Neva, is that we are kind of at this point where we have a foregone conclusion as to what the general election is going to be. Unless there's some Deus Machina event where something happens that we're not expecting out of the sky. Yeah. We're going to see a rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And we're going to see a rematch that is also probably, pretty static in the polls. I mean, we're seeing, poll numbers. There's, not a lot of persuadables out there. We are in a very, tribal political environment in the United States right now. And the idea that there are a lot of persuadable voters out there, it's just not the way that it used to be. I think, you know, Nikki Haley's campaign was kind of counting on that. I mean, she was running this very traditional campaign where you're going out doing rallies every day, sticking to the talking points, not deviating from the messaging, and just wasn't able to move people. The people that matriculated to her campaign were probably people that were going to be there if she hadn't held a single rally. They just wanted an alternative to Donald Trump. So I think that that's, you know, where we did see a lot of, you know, reduced turnout as a result of that, no spending. And because there wasn't any competition, I mean, at least on the Republican side of the ticket, we knew that there was going to be Nikki Haley. We knew that, you know, DeSantis had made the ballot. We knew that Trump was going to be there. And there are a lot of folks that wanted to show up and, you know, demonstrate their allegiance to one of those candidates. On the Democratic side, we haven't had, you know, we didn't have anything. I mean, it's certainly not like the record number of turnout that we saw whenever it was Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton back in 2016, or preferential primaries before that, where we had a very crowded field. And Oklahoma, in some of those contests, actually mattered. At this point, really no state matters. This was really just, you know, letting the ink dry on a book that's already been written for the general election.
Deer Creek School District is getting national attention after students raised more than $150,000 for a local nonprofit hiring workers in disabilities at Oklahoma City coffee shops. It wasn't how much they raised so much as how they raised it. Apparently, kids were licking peanut butter off the toes of other kids. This offended State Superintendent Ryan Walters, ex-account Libs of TikTok, and U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who were all quick to react on social media. Ryan, what's going on here?
I mean, this is, first in the podcast, I admit that I don't know everything. And now I'm going to admit that I kind of agree with Ryan Walters, but not for the same reasons, of course. I mean, but where are the parents at in this deal? Where are the adults? You look at this thing on the internet. I've got a 12-year-old son at home. I can't imagine that he's a few years away from high school himself. Participating in something like this. I mean, come on. This is, and I'm the parent that like takes my kids to go see Jackass in the movies twice. But you know, this is just absolutely ridiculous. I understand that it was for a good cause. It is terrible that the nonprofit that is the recipient of these funds, that primarily helps disabled Oklahomans find jobs and employment and a means to work and have a productive life where they might not otherwise be able to participate in the workforce, they're now being targeted by attacks. And a lot of this comes from the Libs of TikTok crowd, I'm sure. I mean, we don't know that for certain, but I'd put dimes to donuts on this, that this is the Libs of TikTok crowd that are calling and they're insulting the people at this coffee shop, this nonprofit coffee shop, and calling them pedophiles and stuff like that. This isn't an exercise in pedophilia. This is an exercise in just somebody being an idiot and not being able to put their foot down and say, this is not the appropriate way to raise money. I've raised money for organizations all my life, both for my campaigns, for nonprofits. I got my start in nonprofit fundraising or in fundraising with the University of Oklahoma when I was a college student. And I've probably, done some things that, you got to demean yourself a little bit sometimes, but licking peanut butter off of somebody's toes. This is a terrible message to send to these kids, and especially in a world where these images and these videos live forever now. And it's regrettable for these kids. It's regrettable for the school. It's regrettable for everybody all around. And I hope that in the future some adults show up in the room, and that guys like Ryan Walters, even though they look at this and they say this is terrible, call the dogs off. The lesson here isn't let's go attack this business that's doing this nonprofit that's doing very important work in the Oklahoma City metro area. The message is, this was wrong. We need adults in the room to help these kids make good decisions.
Neva.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, unfortunately, the very poor judgment in using this as a vehicle to raise funds has overshadowed the fact that this is an activity that takes place every year in many of the schools across mm-hmm. Oklahoma, where they instill in students the desire to be able to give back to the community, to be able to fundraise and do things that contribute in a significant way. So that clearly was overshadowed in this whole episode. And I think the fact that that the Deer Creek School District was overly silent in the whole proposition. I mean, the statement basically made that the community knows who we are and what we stand for. But I think that there is this bridge that's going to have to be mended. And I think it does point to the fact that it gives those who want to see increased participation by parents in engaged in their local schools, it does kind of give some impetus for that. When you look at the kind of the backstop of all of these other national figures and other folks weighing in, I agree, Ryan, that it doesn't help the situation. I mean, everyone now recognizes, has read, seen, or knows a little bit about what took place. It's over. Hopefully it's been addressed sufficiently internally within the school district and the principals and teachers and all who were involved at some point in that process, and they can move forward from here.
And again, you know, I hope that I failed to mention their name earlier, but it's Not Your Average Joe. That's the nonprofit we're talking mm-hmm. about. It's a local
and I think it was $150,000 raised, so it was not insignificant amount of money.
Almost enough to open a brand new coffee shop for them, which means, you know, so many more employment opportunities for Oklahomans with disabilities. I mean, so that is a really great outcome of this. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, parents, teachers, sponsors, everybody that's involved in that, you know, they didn't step up. I imagine that they will in the future. I hope now that we don't see like an overreaction, though. Where instead of saying, all right, well, let's just you know, not have kids licking peanut butter off of kids' toes, that they swing so far to the other extreme that we've got the kind of involvement that makes it impossible for these kids to be able to raise that kind of money in the future.
The State House quickly advanced legislation to stop the hemorrhaging of Governor Stitt's cabinet after an attorney general's opinion against officials holding more than one public office. Representatives gutted Senate Bill 1196 to allow Agriculture Secretary Blaine Arthur to also serve as the Commissioner of Agriculture. It also opens up the Secretary of Education to be the member of a governing board of a college or university. Neva, do you think the Senate will pass this bill?
It remains to be seen. I would suspect that they probably would, but we'll have to wait. It was interesting on Monday, this particular bill was not on the House agenda. It was brought to the floor under suspension of the rules. They passed it 94-1, I believe it was. So overwhelming, bipartisan, and I think it does set the stage moving forward, as we talked about last week, the fact that this law does allow for exemptions. Many of the exemptions have been special circumstances. I think I read that some of them allow things like park rangers and game wardens to serve on local school boards. That's an exemption. So I think we will see the legislature engage very quickly when they believe that something in this instance that the Attorney General in his determination that these dual office holding positions were not appropriate, were not illegal, that they are able to do this workaround. Will there be others in the cabinet that benefit from this as well? There's not been, from what I've been able to ascertain so far, not that much discussion about it, but certainly as early as we are in this session, I wouldn't rule it out.
Ryan.
I think that that's right. There is this kind of issue of, I think that there are two issues here that remain to be played out. One is a matter of process. If you look, you know, Secretary Arthur has all of these other positions in addition to being Secretary of Agriculture. If you look at the Attorney General's opinion, once you assume another position, you're deemed to have forfeited your last position. So I think that there is this question of, even if we pass these exemptions, is there going to have to be a reappointment process? Is there going to have to be a reconfirmation process? Which of these, because they're ostensibly, I'm not sure of the timing of the other positions that Secretary Arthur was granted by the governor, but which of those was last? And I would tend to think, according to the Attorney General's opinion, whichever is the last is the one that Secretary Arthur rightly holds right now. If you pass this exemption, it's probably not an automatic thing that person automatically becomes those, goes back to those positions again. So I think that there's going to have to be a process there of reappointment and confirmation. And then the other part of it, I think, is policy. And I understand that there's this rush to provide some continuity because a lot of these individuals, like Secretary Arthur, are involved in a number of projects mm-hmm. across a whole menu of obligations that are on their desk. And to pull them out of the game right now could be very difficult for the governor. But at the same time, that policy is there in the that policy of limiting one person to one office with limited exception wasn't just something that was created out of thin air. It was created, I assume, because we as a nation and in particular as a state. And if you look back at the formation and the history of the state of Oklahoma. We were a state of the progressive era. Now, of course, progressive era in 1907 and prior means something maybe than progressive mm-hmm. means today. But one of the things that it did mean was a skepticism of the concentration of power in government in one person or in a small group of people. And so we do have a very dispersed way of allocating governmental power in the state of Oklahoma. And that's for a reason, is because we didn't want one person to be able to make all of these decisions mm-hmm. unilaterally. And I think that as the legislature balances this need to provide continuity in the way things are operating right now, I think that they would be wise to also step back and say, are there some of these positions where we shouldn't put an mm-hmm. exemption there? Because if we have one person that can make all of these decisions, are we putting accountability? Are we also putting the right amount of accountability in those positions as well so that we can hold somebody accountability? Or is there the right amount of transparency? And if you've got somebody that holds all of those positions, maybe there's a part of their job where maybe they're not subject to the Open Meetings Act or the mm-hmm. Open Records Act. Well, they could conduct part of their business over there that would be out of public eye, but could also have a very big impact on another part of their business that would otherwise be subject to the Open Records Act. I mean, I think that they're a lot of policy considerations here as well. And, I think that as the legislature looks at these things, I hope that those conversations are had as well. And in good faith, it's not a matter of any individual that's in office right now or which governor gets to make these appointments, but it's really a matter of the way that we've set up our government in the state of Oklahoma.
The state Supreme Court ruled in favor of an initiative petition to raise the minimum wage. The decision allows supporters to start gathering signatures to place the measure on a ballot at some future date. State Question 832 would increase Oklahoma's minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour by 2029. Ryan, how are proponents feeling about this?
I think that they're feeling great. I think that there really wasn't a question of whether or not this was going to be sufficient to move on to the signature gathering phase. There was some conversation within the court that I think was interesting about the timing of deciding whenever a measure is or isn't in violation of the state constitution. That has been both a debate within the courts and within the legislature in the past few years. And I think that that's important for a couple of reasons. One, the last thing that we want to do is to have the state encumber millions of dollars in expenses and pass and going through a ballot election and pass a ballot measure, and then that ballot measure become law, and that law then immediately be subject to a challenge that it violates the U.S. or the state constitution, and then it's out. And so as a matter of efficiency, trying to understand how something might play with its within the constitutional framework is an important decision to make at the outset mm-hmm. of these ballot measures. It was, when you read the Farm Bureau and the State Chamber, who have really, these guys are the Grinches of ballot measures, unless it's their ballot measure. They hate all ballot measures, but their ballot measures. And their real position in this is really a policy position. I mean, they seem to have been trying to argue to the court that this is bad policy. Well, the court, shouldn't give a flip about whether this is good policy or bad policy. The court is here to decide whether or not it's sufficient under the law. Right. The decision of whether or not this is good or bad policy will ultimately rest with us, the voters, assuming that they're able to get these signatures. The other question is, if they get these signatures, what's the timing of this ballot? We saw with State Question 820, which was the adult use marijuana campaign that I was very involved in, the governor selected a date for the election that had really nothing else on the ballot. It was a time when nobody else was really was ever used to voting at that time. And we saw extraordinarily low voter turnout as a result of that.
Lowest in 10 years.
So do we see, do we get to a point where we get the signatures come in and this thing gets validated, which again, the count that we went through last year was just a nightmare and a train wreck. Is that going to be fixed? And then does the governor then set an election date that is an extraordinary date other than a normal election date and then try to play some politics with this? Who knows? I do think that in terms of initiative petitions, the one thing that everybody should agree on is some certainty. Whether you're the proponents or the opponents of these things, there ought to be more certainty. And if you get your signatures in by this time, then you're going to be on this ballot. If you file your legal challenge by this time, you're going to have a resolution by this date. Because right now, everything is really up in the air, and you can have the best laid plan for a state question, and it all gets turned upside down because of delays at the court, delays in the count, or some intervention by the executive branch.
Neva.
Absolutely, and it will be fascinating what happens moving forward in terms of the process. I think the Secretary of State has basically 30 days or has a period of time where they make sure that there's no other challenges or anything else. Then the date is set. And I think with respect to what the governor does, it will be fascinating because you're right, Ryan. Last year, the March 7th freestanding election that took place on marijuana legalization on that initiative, it was appalling how little participation there was, even though voters say, when you poll them, that they want to protect the initiative process. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, 90% or, some, extremely high number. When you get down to the rubber meeting the road of the elections taking place, the date is oftentimes the critical piece in this. I mean, at least in recent history, when you look at the fact that 820 last year was the only state question since, I think, the early 2000s that didn't take place when you either had another state question or it was on a ballot where you had a general election. And so that definitely has implications. And I think it will be interesting to see how both sides argue, could that benefit them if it is a November election with a much higher turnout because of the presidential ballot. Would that be the opportunity to educate voters on their side of the issue much more effectively? It would certainly be much more costly when you're talking about over 50% of Oklahomans going out to the polls, or I think in 4 years ago it was 69%. Mm-hmm. That changes the dynamic as opposed to something that might be on a runoff ballot or might be on a primary ballot or freestanding. So that will be very interesting. I thought it was interesting that the court, it was a definite split decision. I mean, that 6-3 decision, and you saw Justice Roe in one of his comments in the dissent basically making the point that he felt that the court couldn't make a determination about whether or not a proposal was constitutional until it became law. And so I think the Raise the Wage Oklahoma folks, now they kind of see the roadmap to where they need to go in terms of this the signature signing process. Mm-hmm. What is it, 92,000 or something, much lower than it would be if it were something to go into the Constitution. That pushes 200,000, I think, now. So, this will be something front and center. The Farm Bureau State Chamber obviously disappointed in the ruling this week by the court, but we will see how everyone marches forward in terms of making this. I think what will be a real battle, a real clash in terms of the very different point of view about the significance of whether this passes or doesn't pass for Oklahomans and their future.
Well, in these ballot measures, oftentimes you have considerations by Farm Bureau, by the state chamber, by the advocates of the minimum wage increase itself, and the governor, the other political players. You have two considerations. One, you've got the policy consideration. The Farm Bureau and state chamber say that this will raise prices. The proponents of the measure say that this is necessary to give Oklahomans a livable wage so that they can buy basic things like groceries, and that we have one of the lowest minimum wages in the country, and has really depressed our ability of low-income workers to be able to participate in the economy. But then you also have this political decision as well, because there is a sense, and I'm not entirely sure, how much of this sense is grounded in reality oftentimes, but there is this sense that having a ballot measure on a general election ballot or a primary ballot can influence the type of turnout that you have. So it can change the turnout model, which voters, you might have voters that in November that might otherwise not show up because they think, oh, well, Trump's going to win. It's a foregone conclusion. So I'm just going to stay home. But maybe if I show up because I can vote for this minimum wage, well, that could help down ballot races. Mm-hmm. Or if it's in a primary and you've got Republicans in a primary campaign, well, which of these Republican primary candidates might benefit, or Democratic primary candidates might benefit from a higher turnout based on a minimum wage ballot measure, or any ballot measure for that matter. So I think that goes into the calculus of, you know, which election do we want this on, or like we've mentioned again, you know, does the governor again exercise this this ability that he seems to have now of placing this on a freestanding election and taking the politics of how it might influence a particular election turnout off the table altogether?
Well, and if you look at those last two presidential elections and the fact that we had 68% and 69% of voter participation, that high a turnout, I mean, folks will no doubt pay attention to the state question and mm-hmm. will form an opinion and will cast their vote according to what they believe they want to see happen, whether it's yes or no. So that could be a real factor. And certainly as you think about the backdrop of a presidential year like we're in, I think in Oklahoma what the preference primary this week showed is that Oklahomans, particularly Republicans, by a much larger measure than Democrats and independents demonstrated, they will go and have their voice heard at the ballot box. And I think that is something that we need to focus on in terms of a lot of these discussions, is how the implications of a June ballot, for instance, where there is no statewide governor secondary offices on the ballot, only one corporation commission race. Obviously, you have the federal, you know, congressional races potentially. But that no doubt would curb the turnout because there would be less intensity at the top, but there might be more intensity in communities and counties where you have sheriff's elections and other down ballot courthouse races that would have a lot more interest at the local level. So a lot of dynamics here and a lot of moving parts.
And if you're a state legislative candidate out in that environment and you're out knocking doors, and that's going to be on the ballot at the same time that you're going to be on the ballot,
they want to know what you think.
You can bet that's going to be a litmus question that you get at every doorstep just about.
A Bristow representative is getting ready to become Oklahoma's youngest House Speaker. Kyle Hilbert will take up the gavel in 2025. Neva, what do you think of this selection?
Absolutely. I think when you look at Kyle Hilbert, he is someone who is kind of the next generation to lead the House of Representatives. And in this election this week, this was behind closed doors in a Republican caucus. It was something that really was about a year in the making. As you begin to see changing of the guard, Speaker McCall, 8 of his 12 years in the legislature as the speaker, now term limiting out, and this is his last session, we saw a year ago a lot of folks begin to assess, did they want to run to hopefully be the next Speaker of the House? In this instance, I think when you talk to folks, you see that kind of the path there is, even in the instance of Representative Hilbert in interviews, he stated that he spent the last year going district by district, talking to members in their communities, seeing what they felt was important, wanting to get a pulse out across the state. So it is it's a campaign. It's not a high-profile campaign, but it's a campaign. And now we have someone who is, he will be 30 years old when he takes the role as House Speaker in January, which is, in fact, as you say, Michael, the youngest, not only in Oklahoma history, but only the second Republican speaker that is 30 years or younger in any state since the late 1800s. So there'll be a lot of discussion about his age, but as he pointed out, he's leaning into that because he believes, as he talked about in Washington, where you have the octogenarian politicians in the White House and elsewhere, that there really needs to be younger leaders on the scene who understand, as they do, he and his wife, what it's like to raise a family and what it's like to be out there in their instance. A husband and wife, both in the workforce. His wife is the director of government affairs and policy at Tulsa Community College. Mm-hmm. He's been in the legislature since he was 22 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came in 2016, And so he's well prepared, someone who understands the process, knows the ropes, highly respected among his colleagues, and someone who appears to have a good rapport. And he spoke, I think, recently. I heard him talking about the fact that he had walked across the Capitol to the Senate chambers, and the new Senate-elect leader for the leadership position with Greg McCourtney that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Now we have two young leaders that are going to be the face and be the driving force in the legislature for who knows how many years to come. But I think in this instance, it appeared to be that there was strong sentiment across the board, and I think kudos even from some members across the aisle who have had a strong, positive working relationship with Kyle Hilbert in his time in the legislature. So I think it bodes well for Oklahomans across the board to have leaders in all of these key positions who can do the work and are dedicated and have the energy and commitment to make a positive difference for Oklahoma.
Ryan.
Well, and congratulations to Speaker-designee Hilbert. It is a low-profile campaign, but a very difficult one, as you mentioned, Neva. But he has, you know, handled that campaign very skillfully. I think that, you know, no vote is ever, no election's ever over until you count the votes. And this one technically isn't over until after the elections in November.
Correct.
Right. So the you know, never count your money while you're sitting at the table. You're almost not at the table anymore. So you can kind of start to count it. But I think that
when you have 81 of 101,
absolutely. And which is an extraordinary accomplishment to be able to walk into that closed door election with what, you know, most folks, you know, see as 80 plus votes in your favor is a pretty big deal. Even he had a couple of opponents, but I think that at the end of the day, he had consolidated a majority that was for the longest time well above 60, well above 70 in terms of the support that he had. It made him a very difficult candidate to be able to knock off, and that's not by accident. That's somebody who's run a very solid, strong, smart campaign. I also think that his age does benefit him, and I think that it can benefit the state of Oklahoma. There are, there are a lot of Oklahomans that, you know, are that are in the legislature that, you know, and you know, no disrespect, but are at the end of their careers. You know, they've gone there as to retire, and he's gone there. And you know, while he's been there, he's started a family. He's raising a family. He understands what it is to, you know, have a job where you're getting a W-2. You know, his wife's getting a W-2 from her job. These are kind of normal Oklahoma things. And he comes from Bristow, where, you know, I can't say enough good things about Bristow and the home of my good friend George Crumey. But I think that one of the things that will be interesting is, does he use, and I think that this is an open door for him. Does he begin to think about, are we totally wedded to the way that we've been doing things in the House? And by that I mean committee structure, the way that committees work in the state House of Representatives in Oklahoma. And he's somebody who has, you know, traveled around, gone to all these different conferences, but I feel like whenever he comes back from these conferences, he comes back with legitimate ideas about, you know, how can we make things better in terms of allowing people to testify, creating records within committee meetings, things that are kind of unique in Oklahoma's political government structure within the legislature. I think that, you know, it may just not be, I'm going to be speaker, I'm going to come in and make committee assignments, and I'm going to go raise money for my caucus. I really think that he may be the kind of speaker that comes in and says, I really want to rethink the way that we're operating in the State House of Representatives, and being young and being able to bring a brand new vision to that will allow him to do that. And he walks in with a tremendous amount of political capital to be able to get some really big things done in the House.
And when the news conference took place on Monday and Speaker McCaul basically handed the baton to the designate, I think one of the things that will occur between the end of the legislative session and through the election and through November is that one of the roles that Kyle Hilbert will have is working with members in his caucus to make sure that that there is support, help, financial and otherwise, in their campaigns. I mean, that's one of the roles a speaker has in terms of taking care of the being able to be a driving force in the fundraising and making sure that folks out there know that people in their particular areas need support, need financial help, need a boost for turnout or whatever it happens to be. He has proved to be a very skilled politician in terms of being able to understand and navigate the political dimension to this whole process and winning elections, not only for himself, but being engaged already numerous times with members in the past several years. So he knows how important that is, and I think he will continue what Speaker McCaul did throughout his tenure as Speaker in making sure that his folks had the resources, had the support available to them when needed and necessary, and that's why they have the super majority number that they continue to enjoy right now, 81 out of 101 members in the House.
And relative to all things being considered, he walks in as leader designee to the a House Republican caucus that is more unified than it's been in many, many years. Certainly more unified than the caucus that Speaker McCaul walked into, and so he has a lot of unity within his caucus. But I also think that when you look at the leadership from the Democrats, Leader Cindy Munson, I think that there are a lot of opportunities, and I think Oklahomans want to see these opportunities to partner with thought leaders that aren't in your own party. And yeah, I think that, you know, as a younger politician who I think is, you know, less committed to, or at least, you know, has had less of his political life committed to this, you know, these partisan walls around you, you know, perhaps this is an opportunity for, you know, new leadership and leadership in the House Democrats to find those areas where they can partner together. And we saw with the grocery tax, I haven't seen poll numbers on that, but when you're just out talking to Oklahomans, that's something that Oklahomans are talking about. And they're like, oh my gosh, something finally worked at the Capitol. And it worked because you had everybody together on it. And I think that you've got two leaders in the House now, Cindy Munson and Speaker-designee Kyle Hilbert, who I believe will have the ability to do more stuff like that moving forward.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of KOSU, its staff, or management. Programs like this are made possible through support from KOSU members who are listeners like you. Consider a gift to KOSU in support of This Week in Oklahoma Politics at donate.kosu.org.
Hey there, this is Jenny Mae Harms with KOSU, where we want to talk with you, not just at you. One way we connect with listeners just like you is through social media, like Instagram. So follow us at KOSU Radio, where you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into KOSU reporting, station news, and even ticket giveaways. Just follow KOSU Radio on Instagram, and we'll see you there.